Anybody new? Anybody not familiar with Bhagavad Gita? Okay. It's all me looking mostly at you too. That's all right. As he said, Bhagavad Gita is a very ancient text. The language is in Sanskrit. The speaker is Krishna. And Krishna is speaking to his dear friend Arjuna. Arjuna is a warrior, a hero, a military man. But a very dear friend of Krishna and a very dear devotee of Krishna. So Krishna is revealing truths about the soul and soul's journey to the stage of spiritual perfection. The chapter that is being discussed currently here at the Boston Temple is chapter 10. And in this chapter 10, there are four verses that are known as the essence of the entire Bhagavad Gita. The Bhagavad Gita has 700 verses. And the essence of them is in four verses. So they're packed up verses. And they just immediately precede the one that we're discussing, the last of the four, text 11. Very quick summary of those four verses, and this is now 12 and 13 to be discussed today. The essence of the entire Bhagavad Gita is the relationship of the individual spark of life to the Supreme. And the essence of that relationship is an essence of loving exchange of service and kindness coming back eternally. Forgotten, but is to be revived by processes of yoga. The final attainment of the processes of yoga is yoga of love and devotion. So the first two of those four verses describes the living entity at that stage of perfection in that relationship. There's something they understand. They understand Krishna's position is the source of everything, including themselves. But everything else, everything spiritual, material, everything, Krishna is the source. Knowing that he's the source, with that understanding, they connect with him in ecstatic loving service. And what do they do in that ecstatic loving service? They associate with others who are similarly engaged, and they derive great happiness, satisfaction, and pleasure by katayantaschamamnityam, by speaking about him, remembering him, and engaging in loving service together. Then the final two of the four verses describes what Krishna does. Those are special verses. What does Krishna feel when that first part is there? He reciprocates. It's just like a loving friend or a lover of the beloved, a loving parent, a loving father, mother. He reciprocates with that loving exchange according to how that love is extended to him. He reciprocates. He very kindly gives knowledge in reciprocation how to come to him, and finally he, any residual trace of, you could say, the fragrance of being connected with material consciousness for who knows how many lifetimes, countless number of lifetimes, has completely removed any residual trace of tendency for attraction for matter and trying to be the independent enjoyer of matter apart from our loving relationship with the Supreme. Krishna very kindly withdraws that personally. He makes the connection invincible, indelible. So that's the four verses in a quick summary way, and these verses, these two verses are joined together, 12 and 13. Here, Krishna has just spoken these four verses, and Arjuna goes, wow. Arjuna makes some important declarations. The light goes on, and he realizes, you're not just my dear friend. You're my dear friend. We've been engaging together for our lifetime. They were similar age, and now they're in mature stage of their adulthood, but their whole life has been together in intimate friendship. But you're not just my dear friend. You're the supreme. You're the source of everything. Krishna has just declared it. So here's the Sanskrit and then the translation in purport. And I'm supposed to end at 7 o'clock. Wishing you luck. Arjuna uvacha param brahma pramam param tama pavitram paramam bhavam purusham shashvatam devyam adidevam ajam vibhum abhustvam rishaya sarve devarshir naradas tata asito devalo vyasaha svayam chaiva bhavishyame. In case you don't know Sanskrit, this is the translation. Arjuna said, you are the Supreme Personality of Godhead, the ultimate abode, the purest, the absolute truth. You are eternal, transcendental, the original person, the unborn, the greatest, all the great sages, such as Narada, Asita, Devala, and Vyasa, confirm this truth about you. And now, you yourself are declaring it to me. And purport for these two verses. In these two verses, the Supreme Lord gives a chance to Mayavadi philosopher, for here it is clear that the Supreme is different from the individual soul. Now for those of you that are new, what does that mean? There's a common saying out there in the spiritual marketplace that says things like, it's all one. Making no distinction between the individual and the Supreme, or between anything and anything else, it's all one. This statement here, and Prabhupada is going to develop it a little bit. The knowledge of devotion requires two. There's the lover, there's the beloved, and there's the exchange of love between the two. So there's three things. Or there's diversity, there's plurality. In the spiritual world, in the world of absolutes, there's plurality. So, say it again in a different way, but the same thing. Someone that's involved in day-to-day life understands there's something missing. There's this pinch of something that's very dissatisfying, or worse, in material existence. And here is a place of duality. It's Boston. Sometimes it's cold. Sometimes it's hot. Not too often, but sometimes it's hot. Sometimes it's night. Sometimes it's day. Sometimes I'm happy. Sometimes I'm sad. Sometimes I'm honored. Sometimes I'm dishonored. And whatever, anything you can think of, there's its opposite, because it's the nature of the place. It's a place of duality. But I want a spiritual place. So the spiritual place, by inverse logic or by negation, the absolute must be without variety. It's all one. That's spiritual for you. It's all one. Bhagavad Gita is teaching all realm. That absolute realm has all kinds of diversity, but there's harmony within that diversity because of the mood of love. Say the same thing in another way. It'd be pretty boring if there's no love. But love then has its option of not love. I want to leave you. I want to have nothing to do with you. But if you choose to be with someone out of love, that's love. It's voluntary. That means I have free will, and they also have free will. They can say, no, I'm not interested. So love requires two. In this spiritual realm, there's love. It requires two. It requires plurality, many. So it's a philosophical issue. In the absolute realm, it's all one, or is there diversity? So some people hold the view there's no love and there's no diversity. It's just oneness. Homogeneous oneness. Put all the varieties into a blender, turn it on high speed, and you get a smoothie. It's all one. That's a point of view. People that in the have a... So that's what this first sentence is referring to. And Prabhupada is very politely saying, Krishna's making it really easy. It's not all one. There's the living entity, and there's the supreme living entity, and there's a relationship of love between the two. So there's diversity. Arjuna, after hearing the essential four verses of Bhagavad Gita in this chapter, became completely free from all doubts and accepted Krishna as the supreme personality of Godhead. He at once boldly declares, "You are Para Brahma, the Supreme Personality of Godhead." For those of you that are not familiar with Sanskrit, Brahma in this case means spirit. There's this realm of spirit, and Krishna is Para Brahma, there's Supreme Spirit. So we're qualitatively Brahman, we're also spirit, tiny. An individual, tiny, 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 individual, 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 like little sparks of a fire. And then there's the big fire. Para. Brahma. Para means transcendental or supreme. So Arjuna is saying, I'm not the supreme Brahman. You are. I'm tiny Brahman, you're the supreme Brahman. And I like that because it's a relationship of love. I want to serve you. You're the supreme. And previously Krishna stated that he's the originator of everything and everyone. Every demigod and every human being is dependent on him. What's a demigod, for those of you that are new? Demigod means there's controllers of the universe. As every religion teaches, Bible teaches, God creates. So there's that which is created, there's this place, the creation, the cosmic manifestation, and there's the creator. And he doesn't just whimsically create and leaves it hanging there. He has administrators that look after the creation. That's what these demigods are. They're administrators of the affairs of the cosmic manifestation. Someone's in charge of water, and someone's in charge of air, and someone's in charge of light. Someone's in charge of heat, someone's in charge of everything. Vegetation, everything. There's somebody in charge of everything. It's not a whimsical creation, it's looked after. It's maintained by maintaining agents that are given the power to do the maintenance by the Creator, by the Supreme. So that's what demigods are. There's a lot of 33 million that are looking after the cosmic manifestation, maintaining the affairs of cosmos, demigods. Men men and demigods out of ignorance think that they are absolute and independent of the Supreme Personality of God, that ignorance is removed perfectly by the discharge of devotional service. This has already been explained in the previous verse. Now, by His grace, Arjuna is accepting, by His grace, is Krishna's grace, Arjuna is accepting Krishna as the Supreme Truth in concordance with the Vedic injunction. It is not that because Krishna is Arjuna's intimate friend, Arjuna is flattering him by calling him the Supreme. Oh, my dear friend, you're the Supreme. Not like that. Whatever Arjuna said in these two verses is confirmed by Vedic truth. Vedic means these ancient texts that Bhagavan was referring to, the thousands of 5,000-year-old texts that confirm the same thing. So Arjuna is saying, the texts say it, the great sages said it, you've just said it, I accept it. Squeaky clean, no doubt. Whatever was lack of clarity was there. The light's on now. I understand it very clearly. Vedic injunctions affirm that only one who takes to devotional service to the Supreme Lord can understand him, whereas others cannot. Each and every word of this verse spoken by Arjuna is confirmed by Vedic injunction. To understand Krishna through devotional service is really common sense. Really common sense. To know somebody, you can hear about somebody, and that's, you know, so you know something third hand about somebody. But if you, it's such, you know something about them that may be partially right, partially maybe not right. But if you constantly are with that person day and night and night and day and day and night and night and day and on and on and on, and you're intimately connected with that person through activities together, you can understand a lot about that person that other people don't understand about that person. Get married. You find out a lot about the other person that you didn't know before you got married. You know, think, oh, he's nice, she's nice, and live together. You find out, well, they're nice, but there's some other things there too. And you didn't know until you got married. And then you learn how to live together, knowing all that you know about the other person. This is common sense. And similarly, by the medium of devotional service, that is two things. It's what you do and what your thoughts are, your mood, your emotion, the external and the internal, connected to Krishna in practical activity, always thinking of him. You understand about him. He discloses himself through that medium of devotional service. That's what's being said here. Paragraph 2 of 3. Now here are some references from the Upanishads, for those of you that are new. What's the Upanishads? The Upanishads is a philosophical portion of this vast body of ancient wisdom literature. They're called the Vedas. It's a philosophical portion. They teach it at, you know, Harvard University Divinity School. Or other colleges that teach the Vedas, there's a section that teaches the Upanishad. It's standard texts. So he's making reference to those. In the Kena Upanishad, it is stated that the Supreme Brahman is the rest, or shelter, for everything. And Krishna has already explained that everything is resting on him. That's the first of those four verses, Chaturshloki verses. Next, the Mundaka Upanishad confirms that the Supreme Lord, in whom everything is resting, can be realized only by those who engage constantly in thinking of him. The constant thinking of Krishna is smaranam, Sanskrit word, remembrance. One of the methods of devotional service. It is only by devotional service to Krishna that one can understand his position and get rid of this material body. Well, wait a minute. I like my material body. It means ending the cycle of birth and death. The Eastern literature is replete with this understanding that the soul is journeying one body to the next body to the next body and on and on and on, bound by the cycle of birth and death. Samsara, it's called. The wheel of birth and death. So speaking of getting off the wheel of birth and death, and then if you get off the wheel of birth and death, where do you go? You go to the eternal abode of Krishna, if your mind is upon Krishna. There's a nice verse in Bhagavad Gita. Krishna says, whatever your mind is fixed on, at the moment of that, the mind will carry you to the next situation. So those whose thoughts are high, you go to a higher place. Those whose thoughts are in Boston, you stay in Boston. Those who thoughts are very low, you'll go to a hellish place. And those whose thoughts are absorbed in transcendence with Krishna, you go to Krishna. No more birth, no more material body, no more 9 months in the womb of the mother and growing up and going goo goo gaga and becoming a teenager and getting spun out. And you don't have to go through that anymore. No more. No more birth and death. Again, in the Vedas, the Supreme Lord is accepted as the purest of the pure, making reference to one of Arjuna's statements, pavitram. Pavitram means pure. Purest of the pure. When one understands that Krishna is the purest of the pure, can become purified from all sinful activities, purified, really simple. You come in contact with Supreme Pure, you become purified. And not that the Supreme Pure becomes contaminated. Prabhupada's example, when the sun shines on an impure place like a puddle of urine, the sun doesn't become contaminated. The water gets evaporated, the water comes down as rain, distilled water. And the contaminated place becomes disinfected by the power of the sun. So we become purified by that process of fixing the mind upon the Supreme Pure. Very logical and very practical. One who cannot be disinfected from sinful activities, unless he surrenders unto the Supreme Lord, Arjuna's acceptance of Krishna as the Supreme Pure complies with the injunctions of Vedic literature. This is also confirmed by great personalities of whom Narada is the chief. That list of, not only my opinion, this is what all the great sages say, starting Narada and others. We're almost done. We're getting close to 7 o'clock. Krishna is the Supreme Personality of Godhead, and one should always meditate upon him and enjoy one's strength of relationship with him. He's the Supreme Existence. He is free from bodily needs, free from birth and death. Not only does Arjuna confirm this, but all the Vedic literatures, the Puranas and histories. In all Vedic literatures, Krishna is thus described. And the Supreme Lord himself also says in the fourth chapter, much earlier in Bhagavad Gita, although I am unborn, I appear on this earth to establish religious principles, unquote. He is the supreme origin. It's like, all right, I get it. He's saying it so many times. All right. But that's quite significant. I wish I had more time. I had, during the course of this past few weeks, one of the places I visited was Champaign-Urbana, University of Illinois. And one of the persons I met there is a professor, newly arrived professor of physics, from Indian background, and did his PhD studies in America. Now he's on a track to become a tenured physics professor. And he's newly acquainted with the Bhagavad Gita's message and the Vedic literature's message. And we just had this nice discussion and some exchange since then. In physics, it's looking at the cause and effect of things, but like, what's the original cause? What's the cause of that cause? That cause that creates an effect is the effect of some prior cause, and that's the effect of some prior cause, the effect of some prior cause. So like, in physics, it's just an accepted fact that there's a Big Bang, and you're not supposed to ask, what caused the bang? You're just not, it says you don't go there. It's one of the rules of physics. You're going to be a physics professor, you don't ask the question. You don't teach the students to ask the question. You just have this assumption there was a Big Bang, then you do all the math and the physics of. So, you know, like, how do I help my colleagues understand that there's a cause of the Big Bang? Where does everything come from? So he's repeating it over and over again, and there's a reason. Because largely, modern society is very influenced by what scientists say. Without going into a whole big thing on it, because it's easy to go into a whole big thing on it. I won't. I'm tempted. But there isn't time. The clock is still moving. The Vedic declaration is, there is a source of everything, and you can ask the question, and this singularity or whatever notion they give to it, name they give to it, this the where the Big Bang came from, this unlimited mass in a dimensionless point, where the unlimited mass, how did it get into a dimensionless point? Don't ask that question. It existed, and then kaboom, it exploded. That's the Big Bang, and mass went flying all over the place, and the universe is expanding. And you know, according to what my exchange with him, it's the scientists say the rate of movement of the particles that are expanding is accelerating, and you know, they have some interesting way of describing why that's so. Black matter. Huh? Don't ask what the animal will explain what it is, but you just have to accept it because we're scientists. Anyway. The Vedic model also says the universe is expanding, but it's expanding from a source, and there's reason why it exists and why it's expanding, and then it's also going to contract and go back to this singularity, or go back to the body of Mahavishnu. There's a model where the Vedic model is the source of everything is the Supreme Person. Modern scientific model is the source of everything is a dimensionless point of unlimited matter. And don't ask us where that came from. It's primordial. That's God. Okay. We won't talk about it. The Vedic picture is very clear. There is a source, and the source is a person. And there's a relationship with that person because we're part of the source. We come from that supreme. He is the supreme origin. He has no cause, for he is the cause of all causes, and everything is emanating from him. This perfect knowledge can be had by the grace of the Lord. Again, referring to the text previous, the medium of devotional service permits one to realize that. There's knowledge, there's text that explains what it is and how it works, and there's a method of realizing it factually. Realizing it factually. Like perceiving it in the seat of consciousness. Is the methodology is there for that perception, that real full realization, not, well, that sounds interesting, but realizing, which is different than theory. We have 4 minutes. One more paragraph, sure. Here, Arjuna expresses himself for the grace of Krishna. If we want to understand Bhagavad Gita, we should accept the statements of these two verses. This is called the Parampara system. Acceptance of the disciplic succession. Unless one is in the disciplic succession, he cannot understand Bhagavad Gita. It is not possible by so-called academic education. Unfortunately, those proud of their academic education, despite so much evidence in Vedic literatures, stick to their obstinate conviction that Krishna is an ordinary person. End of purport. Little anecdote, and then I think we're going to end because the conch is going to blow and the RT is going to start. Once upon a time, so many years ago, I was a college student. Maybe 40-something years ago. And I had a philosophy professor. His name was George Bober, a nice man. He had a friendship outside of the classroom. He was a poet. And he was a Taoist. I didn't know what Taoism was. I came to understand later. And we used to go to the pottery room and make pots together. And he would, you know, describe to me what that does for him, you know, internally. It would help him get centered. And, you know, even then, the language is be in the moment. And I had a nice relationship. So one day he gave me a book. I couldn't pronounce the title of the book. It was Bhagavad Gita. I thought it was a book of poetry because we would talk about poetry. So I was carrying it around along with my textbooks and clipboard and stuff. And another friend of mine said, oh, I have one of those, but it's different. Here, let me give you mine. Another translation of Bhagavad Gita. So I said, gee, let me find out more about this. So I went to the library and I found 5 more translations of Bhagavad Gita. So I checked out all 5, I read all 7, and I came to 2 conclusions. It's not a book of poetry, and the other conclusion is I don't understand it. Some time passed, and somebody gave me Bhagavad Gita as it is. I started reading number 8, and it was really easy to understand. And I was like scratching my head, why is it really easy to understand? And the other 7, I couldn't understand at all. But I kept reading it, and then I gradually could understand why I could understand it. It was based in devotion. It was based on realization. It wasn't based on academic power. So I'm scholar so-and-so, and I went to school at such-and-such place, and I learned Sanskrit, and now I'm doing a translation of Bhagavad Gita. It's not understood that way. It's not understood by the ascending method. It's understood by this descending method. The language here is parampara. By hearing descending knowledge from Krishna and or from the representative of Krishna who heard from Krishna, or one who heard from the representative who heard from the representative who heard from Krishna. Through the disciplic succession, that knowledge is then passed on. That's how to understand it. And otherwise, read as many Bhagavad Gita as you like. And you're not going to understand it, because they don't understand it either. Because it's not how Bhakti is to be understood. It's this descending method. So, conclusion. It's 30 seconds to go. Read Bhagavad Gita. Read it in this method that there's descending knowledge coming through this particular translation, Bhagavad Gita as it is. And just, like, put your receivers on. You don't have to believe anything. It's not a requirement. Just turn your receivers on. What's the signal? What's being said here? What is it that that Krishna wants to say and the commentators wants to say? What's the message of it? You don't have to believe it. Just receive it and consider it carefully. And whatever it is that resonates, part two, whatever it is that resonates inside, do it. Like, you know, act, practically apply that which really makes sense to you and see what happens. You'll get some realization. When you act in knowledge, the result is realization. Yeah, that's right. And then it gives you enthusiasm to go back to the source that you heard from and say, I want to hear some more. And that way, gradual spiritual progress is made. I invite you all to do that. Srila Prabhupada ki jai.